The Guardian.
There was one time, about 10 years ago, and I was doing research in the rainforest in Borneo. It was in primary untouched rainforest. And one of the local guys asked me if I'd like to go fishing with him. And I pulled this fish out and I looked at it and I grabbed hold of it. And the fish swung round and with one of its pectoral fins, it stabbed me in the side of the finger. And I was afflicted by this extremely intense pain that shot down my finger, down my arm, and then throughout my whole body.
This was bad news for Tim, as it was a type of venomous catfish that had barbed him. But he didn't know what species it was. How was he supposed to know whether to rush to hospital or not? And if he did, how would the doctors know how to treat him? Tim turned to the local who'd invited him fishing.
He looked at me and he said, "Oh, Tim, this is really, really bad." And I thought that I had minutes to live, but in fact, it was just because he was ashamed of the fact that he hadn't told me. And it was fine in the end, but I thought that I had minutes to live after being stung by a potentially undescribed species.
Blimey, that sounds terrifying. I'm glad you're okay.
It was, yeah. I think that's probably as close as I can get.
Tim was lucky, but you can easily see how different things could have been. What if it was venomous enough to kill him? Either way, Tim would have needed to know what the species was. And to me, this really illustrates just how important the field of taxonomy is. It could save your life. But what happens if scientists can't agree on what a species is?
In a way, there are no objective ways of defining where one species starts and when another species stops.
On Science Weekly, we look at the subjectivity of this branch of science and the rise of taxonomic vandalism. That's the naming of species for the glory, without having much supporting evidence. And we ask, could genomics help the situation?
DNA barcoding is a way of identifying plants, animals, but instead of using its physical appearance, we use its DNA instead.
I'm Greer Jackson, and this is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hi, Tim. It's Greer calling from The Guardian.
Hi, Greer. How are you doing?
I'm really well. How are you?
Really well, thanks. All good.
All good. Well, can we start? Can I just get you to introduce yourself to our listeners? Who are you and what you do?
Yes, I am Dr. Tim Cockerill and I'm a senior lecturer in natural history at the University of South Wales.
As you've already heard, Tim has spent a lot of his working life exploring the rainforests and studying the creatures of Borneo. And as a result, he knows a lot about how we decide whether something is a new species or not. But Tim tells me that it's not as straightforward as you might think.
This is a problem that has plagued science for hundreds of years, so I'll try my best. So the process of describing a new species relies very much on the expertise of people called taxonomists. And these are the people who, as a living, describe new species and the relationships between them. And so usually a taxonomist will be out collecting specimens or they'll be working in a natural history museum where they'll receive a specimen from somebody else. And the first step is essentially to compare that specimen to all of the other specimens that might be closely related to it and to see if it is different. And usually you have to compare very, very specific characters. So in some families of beetles, for example, you might have to dissect out the genitalia of these beetles and look at the size and shape of those genitalia and compare them to other closely related things. In some other insects, it might be just the shape of the ridges on the side of the head or the number of hairs on the legs. And so you have to compare these very specific characters. And if you have something with an unusual set of characters, well, then you can be reasonably certain that it is a new species.
And when you're looking at these beetles, say, and looking at their genitalia or their hairs on their legs, is it always the physical characteristics and traits that you're using to distinguish species? Or are you looking at other things like how they behave?
Well, the Traditional taxonomy is based on morphology, on what things actually look like externally. But there's a slight difficulty here in that the way that we define species is actually based upon this thing called the biological species concept. And it's the species concept that is used most commonly. And it basically says that for something to be considered a species, well, it has to be reproductively isolated from other groups, which basically means that in nature, if you have populations of individuals all interbreeding together, well, then we consider them part of the same species. But if they are isolated, if they're not interbreeding with each other, or if they're unable to interbreed, well, then we can consider them a different species.
So there's the morphology. And then there's also the reproductive element. Dogs are a really good example of this. They come in all shapes and sizes, from a Chihuahua to a Great Dane. If we put the logistics of how that pairing would happen aside, technically, a Great Dane and a Chihuahua can have babies. That's all fine and lovely, but something my producer Max raised is how accurate is taxonomy?
Is there like an objective kind of guideline that gives you an idea of those differences, as opposed to it just being down to the person? Is there any way that we can try and objectify that?
When it comes to traditional morphological taxonomy, in a way, there are no objective ways of defining where one species starts and when another species stops. So it very much comes down to the opinion of the taxonomic community as to just how different looking an animal has to be or a plant has to be to consider it a different species to its close relatives.
Gosh, so if it's really subjective, it's a subjective science defining what a new species is or isn't, I imagine there's some debate, really, and arguments within the field about whether something qualifies as a new species or not. I know the marble crayfish is one, for example.
That's right. The marble crayfish is a really interesting example. This is something that was discovered in the aquarium trade in the 1990s, where somebody, an enthusiast in keeping these kind of animals, suddenly discovered that they had a bunch of crayfish that were reproducing parthenogenetically. Now, what this means is that we have a bunch of female crayfish that are able to reproduce without the assistance of males. So the females can lay fertilized eggs. And the offspring of these females are also female, and they are genetic clones. Now, this was the first time this had been known in this kind of animal. And scientists tried to find an equivalent in the wild. They tried to find a parthenogenetically reproducing crayfish, and they couldn't find one. Now, it's thought that
they did find a species of crayfish that was similar, though, sometimes called the slough crayfish. However, when they put the marbled crayfish with the slough crayfish, they mated, but the females produced clones of themselves. There was none of the father's DNA in the offspring.
Some experiments have been done with the wild counterpart of the marble crayfish, and the females go through the normal business when you put them together with the male wild crayfish, and they do mate with them. But then when you analyse the genetics of their offspring, well, it shows that the males haven't contributed anything. So the females are still producing these genetic clones of themselves, even when they've mated with a male. So technically, they are completely reproductively isolated from their wild counterpart species. But if you get them under the microscope, if you look at one of these things, they look exactly the same, and genetically, they are very, very similar as well. So it raises the question, are these things that we have in captivity that are reproducing in a completely different way to its wild counterparts, are they still part of that original species, or should we consider them something completely new?
But it's not just the world of crayfish where issues around new species have arisen. It's a contentious subject, and one that's led some scientists to cry taxonomic vandalism.
Thank you. Yes, well, traditionally, when taxonomists have been basing everything in the description of new species on the morphology of plants and animals, so basically how they look, well, often this leads to very, very heated debates when you get people essentially that disagree with each other. So one person will say, well, I think these are two separate species, and then another person will say, well, no, I don't think that your evidence is strong enough, and I think these are actually just two members of the same species. And it leads to people being labelled as lumpers or splitters. And so the splitters are people that look at a group of species or a species complex and say, actually, we've got 10 different species occurring across the whole range here. And then the lumpers are people who would look at exactly the same specimens, exactly the same evidence, and would say, actually, we've got maybe one or two species that just has a very wide distribution. And really, this just kind of highlights the subjectivity that can be involved in morphological taxonomy. But it also means that whole process is open to abuse to some extent, because people who like perhaps the glory of naming a new species or describing new things and publishing the idea that I've come up with something that is completely new to science, well, they might take this example where you have lots of species that are perhaps on the verge of being species, and they're going to say, oh, hang on, look, I've discovered 10 new species and I've given them 10 very sexy new names, and I'm going to publish them in my own journal, and everybody else just has to put up with it. And people sometimes describe this as taxonomic vandalism, where you get these kind of rogue taxonomists that just go out and essentially they are looking for new species. So they're not trying to be objective, they're not trying to be as objective as possible and to look at the evidence. They're searching through the literature and they're searching through specimens, trying to find something that they can describe as a new species.
Why is that a problem?
The species is our basic unit of describing the natural world. So knowing how many species are in a particular area or even worldwide or in a particular taxonomic group is massively, massively important. First of all, just from the kind of curiosity-based research or curiosity-driven research, it's just as important to describe how many species there are on planet Earth as it is to classify the different types of rock that there are or to classify the number of planets in the solar system or stars that we can see in the sky. So just from that very basic way of understanding the world around us, it's very important. So this idea of rogue taxonomists, these taxonomic vandals that are going out and just describing species willy-nilly when they don't really exist, well, it might give us a skewed impression of what actually exists in nature.
So, what to do about the few who threaten to topple taxonomy? After the break, we're going to be looking at a possible solution, something called DNA barcoding.
Well, DNA barcoding really is the first time in the entire history of taxonomy that we have something that at least leads us towards an objective distance between species. It's the first time really that we can turn all of that information about a species into an objective number. So we can now say, and it's something that we just couldn't do before, we can say that, oh, these two species here have a 97% genetic similarity. And then once we've decided on those limits between one species and another, well, then we can use DNA barcoding to say, oh, hang on, this is going to solve the problem completely. This is going to clear up the argument, and we say that these are sufficiently closely related based on their DNA to consider them the same species or perhaps a different species.
I'll be back in a minute. In 2011, political activist and blogger Aya Shebi was part of a national uprising that saw the president of Tunisia resign and flee. Now she's the African Youth Coordinator at the World Peace Initiative, an international organisation that promotes peace around the world.
So I was travelling around the continent, training youth in blogging, in mobilisation, civil resistance. And when I realised that common struggle, I started this platform called Africa Youth Movement to bring all these organisers together to think about how we can accelerate change on the continental level and think beyond our countries and beyond our own national struggles.
Join me, Lucy Lamble, to hear more about this revolutionary's work in this week's episode of Small Changes.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Greya Jackson. Before the break, we looked at how you define a new species and how the loopholes in this ill-defined science means that a few are naming new taxa for the glory rather than for the sake of science. But could sequencing the DNA of these newly discovered species stop the rise of so-called taxonomic vandalism?
Hiya.
Hi, Natasha. This is something I'm hoping Dr. Natasha Devere can help me answer.
I'm head of science at the National Botanic Garden of Wales.
Natasha has used something called DNA barcoding to not only help us better categorise plants and animals, but also to help us quantify the relationship between them. For instance, honeybees and the plants they like to visit. But what exactly is DNA barcoding?
So DNA barcoding is a way of identifying things. So it's quite simple. It's a way of identifying plants, animals, fungi, but instead of using its physical appearance, we use its DNA instead.
And are you using the whole section of DNA, or are you just looking at a distinct section of it?
That's the beauty of DNA barcoding, because we don't use the whole genome, because that would be quite time consuming. So what we use is a tiny, quite short fragment of DNA. So for plants, for example, one of the fragments we use is just 500 base pairs long. So that's 500 of the A's, T's, G's and C's that make up the DNA sequence.
And how distinct do these two sections of DNA need to be? Because you often hear about that statistic that around 98% of our genes, human genes, are shared with chimps. So how distinct do these two tiny sections of DNA need to be?
We need to find bits of DNA amongst all of the genome of a plant or animal, which are different between species, but aren't too different, because otherwise you pick up lots of individual differences as well, and it's too difficult.
It's odd to think that plants have individual differences when, to most people, myself included, we take one look at a few oak trees and think they all look the same. But like some of us have blue eyes and others green or brown, plants also have traits that distinguish them from each other. It's these little quirks within a plant's DNA that can make it difficult to barcode. That's why Natasha is looking for a section of DNA that's different to other species, but relatively uniform within a species. And apparently, there are two segments of DNA that fit the bill in plants.
One of those is within the nucleus, and that's where most of the genetic material is held. That's the meaning kind of instruction manual. And we use a little section in there called ITS2. And that's really good at distinguishing different species from each other. But sometimes it doesn't work for all of our plants. And then we use another section of DNA, it's called RBCL, and that's amongst the DNA within the chloroplast. The chloroplast is where photosynthesis happens within a plant, but it also has some genetic material as well.
It seems like a really obvious thing to do, to compare sections of DNA between species. So why has it taken so long to do this? Why are we only seeing this sort of technology now?
So that's a really interesting question, because ever since we've known about DNA, people have used it for identification and for classifying organisms. But it was only in 2003 that a professor from the University of Guelph, Paul Herbert, he came up with this term, DNA barcoding. And it was actually really revolutionary, because what he was saying was, well, instead of us all looking at little bits of different DNA and just putting it within our sort of individual scientific papers, how about we work together? How about we create an international community of scientists to DNA barcode the entire world? So that was one of the big sort of step forwards in terms of DNA barcoding. But the other big technological advancement was next generation DNA sequencing. So up till then, you could take one sample and you would get one DNA barcode back. But often you want to look at a mixture. So if I look at my pollinating insects and want to know what they've had for dinner, they've actually got pollen from lots of different plants on their bodies. So I need to be able to look at the DNA within a mixture. And next generation DNA sequencing has enabled that to happen. So the techniques we can use for DNA barcoding are advancing at a really rapid rate.
So you can see how this might be useful to botanists like Natasha. But could this be used to solve the taxonomic vandalism problem that Tim Cockerill outlined before? Not quite. Natasha believes it's one more bit of kit to add to the toolbox.
Oh, very much so. It's a bit more like, you know, taking out your ID guide. So you've got your ID guide, you've got your key. You can also use DNA as well. And the beauty of the DNA is the ability to use that in situations where you simply couldn't use just what it looks like. And that's really where you can do additional things with it.
There was a great example of the giant house spider in the UK, which is the species that you see running out from underneath the sofa when you're watching TV in the autumn. And up until very recently, it was considered that there were several different species in the UK, and people had even described the ranges and where these overlap. There was one species that lived in the east of the UK and another that lived in the west, and there was a kind of line down the middle where it was thought they may be overlapped or maybe hybridized. And then some researchers took loads and loads of specimens of these spiders and they barcoded them genetically and looked at them under microscopes and described them morphologically, and they said, well, hang on, we think actually it's all the same species. So these things that we considered as two species or three species with these overlapping ranges has now been described as just one species that lives across the whole of the UK. But even since then, even with the advent of genetic technology, well, then other people have published papers after that saying, oh no, I disagree with you. Although it's maybe one species, well, we've definitely got these populations in the UK that at least look different to each other. So even with the advent of DNA technology, well, the debate rages on as to exactly how to describe and to define a species.
So a lot of the work we do is on pollinators, and we are really interested in what the best plants are for different pollinating insects. And that's a really important question. 75% of our crops, all of our wildflowers, are dependent on insect pollination, and insects are facing huge declines. And one of the reasons for that is lack of flowers, just lack of food within the environment. So we want to find out more about exactly what plants different pollinators need so that we can help to provide those.
Nature is a weird and wonderful thing that doesn't fit neatly into glass cabinets or well-defined categories. Species are fluid, evolving in an ever-changing world. Nonetheless, classifying species is an important task in innumerable ways, from conservation and understanding adaptations to climate change, to ensuring that Tim doesn't die from a dangerous catfish attack.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much, Tim.
All right, okay. Take care, both. Bye. See you. Bye.
Special thanks to Tim Cockerill and Natasha Devere for sharing their expertise and for making Science Weekly possible. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can tweet us 280 characters at Guardian Audio or drop us a line via email. It's scienceweekly@theguardian.com. All that's left to do is to thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.